From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. A new analysis of financial aid data from some 1,400 institutions suggests that the net cost of college attendance for low-income students at hundreds of colleges may equal up to half the family's annual earnings. And advocates for the disabled want new legislation incorporated into the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act that would set technical standards for accessibility to curricular resources and digital services. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation today, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. Undermining Pell Grants. A report out from the New America Foundation this week states that many colleges have created huge barriers affecting the college aspirations of and college costs for low-income students. Quote, hundreds of colleges expect the neediest students to pay an amount that equals at least half their family's yearly earnings, end quote. The foundation's analysis of net costs during the 2011-2012 academic year at more than 1,400 four-year public and private nonprofit colleges and universities reveals that many institutions that ultimately have a high net price for low-income students, as reflected by the number of students who receive Pell Grants, also provide deep discounts, no-need scholarships, sometimes promoted as merit aid, to students from more affluent families who need little or no financial aid. While high net costs for low-income families and more merit aid for affluent students is more common at private nonprofit institutions, it is also becoming an increasingly significant issue at public institutions that seek academically talented or wealthy students to enhance institutional prestige and also to balance institutional budgets. Moreover, the foundation reports that, quote, there's compelling evidence to suggest that many schools are engaged in an elaborate shell game using Pell Grants to supplant institutional aid that they would have otherwise provided to financially needy students, and then shifting these funds to help recruit wealthier students, end quote. Joining us for this conversation are Stephen Bird, a senior policy analyst at the New America Foundation and the author of this report, and Doug Letterman, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome both. So, Steve Bird, let me turn to you to sort of help frame this a little more. The number of Pell Grant recipients more than doubled between 2001 and 2011, and Pell Grant funding also rose dramatically from about $4 billion to $32 billion during the same period. Yet the report that you prepared for the foundation suggests a significant change in financial aid fundings during this period to the disadvantage of low-income students in both public and private nonprofit institutions. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that is a fair assessment. I think it's one of the things that's interesting is that even though we've seen an enormous growth in Pell Grant funding, we haven't seen a decrease in student loan borrowing by low-income students. In fact, I believe the rate has stayed pretty much the same, and low-income students are taking out more in debt. So the question is sort of what isn't happening, and I think one of the things is that colleges are just not, or a lot of colleges are not complementing the government's efforts, but instead are redirecting their financial aid to wealthier students.
Well, when you say not complementing, that is this something new? Was there a time when they once did, and then for issues of prestige or revenue, you know, individually, but in aggregate, they've decided, this is an opportunity, let's go elsewhere?
There was a time when colleges were much more in tune with what the government was doing to open the doors of college to low-income students. It's been, I would say it's over the past few decades. I wouldn't say that it's all happened between 2001 and 2000 and now, but over the past few decades, many colleges have shifted their priorities and instead are using their institutional aid dollars to attract students they desire, best and brightest and the wealthiest. This goes back a while for the private colleges, but has been a more recent phenomenon for public universities.
Doug Letterman, this would seem to give fuel to the arguments of congressional critics and others that financial aid has allowed institutions to cook the rules of the game, if you will, if not raise tuition, at least sort of shift the portfolio of the revenue portfolio of their students. Is that fair as well?
Well, it certainly makes it harder. Evidence like this from Numerica and work that Education Trust has done certainly make it harder to financial aid experts have always argued that there is no evidence that federal aid lifts encourages the lifting of tuition. And again, it's hard to know exactly. I'm not enough of an expert to be able to prove that, but these kind of data certainly suggest that there is the colleges are moving money around and using the federal financial support to shift their own dollars for other purposes. And now, and the institutions will complain and say, note that there are a lot of institutions that are pouring more of their own dollars into financial aid. Institutional aid is increasing, as I understand it. But the question is, what this raises is really what they're using that aid for. And there are obviously some that are using it for need-based aid, and others, a lot of others, an increasing number of others that are using it for other kinds of aid that aren't necessarily based on students' financial need. And that is a shift, and as Steve said, it's one that's been going on for a while with the privates, and the states are now getting into the act, particularly with some of their big lottery-funded scholarship funds.
So, Steve, what are the characteristics of the campuses that have been doing this shift, moving around? I call it the shell game, as you did in the report, where low-income students may have very high costs and the pursuit of other students, wealthy, extremely talented students in the quest for prestige or revenue.
I mean, we're seeing this both, again, on the private side and increasingly at the publics. You see it in the publics mostly, a lot of it happening more at the flagship universities and big research universities.
You name names. I mean, you've cited a couple of institutions, and we've seen there's been a sort of, and I want to be careful about this, kind of a packed journalism about this issue over the last couple of weeks. The New York Times has run some articles ahead of their index that was released last week, which we covered in our This Week program, stories about low-income students paying very high fees. What's the catalyst for all this new attention, Steve?
Well, I think, that there is generally a concern for, how are schools doing by their low-income students. I think maybe part of it is that we've seen the federal government actually step up to the plate. There was a long time when funding for Pell Grants really lagged, and so you could sort of put a lot of your attention on what is the federal government doing. But at least now we've seen a fairly big investment into the grants. And so the question is, what are colleges doing? What are states doing? I think that has become a bigger issue because of that. On the naming of names, I think, it's important for this not just to be a theoretical discussion, but to really identify schools at which some of these practices are happening.
Doug Letterman, I mean, again, let me ask the PAC journalism to you. Is this because this is just an easy target, or in fact, is there a bigger and deeper story here?
Well, there's a bunch of things going on. I mean, I think, as Steve said, there has been a ratcheting up, a significant increase under this administration and it's actually started to some extent in Pell with the last administration, but there was a really significant increase in the amount of federal money flowing to students indirectly to institutions. And we are seeing a much more general reckoning desire on the federal government to ask how well those dollars are being spent, how effectively, whether they are driving student completion. So sort of a general increase in questioning of what institutions are doing with this newfound money. So that's one aspect. The other is that we are, I think we're sort of finally seeing and it's been interesting, to some extent, we've seen some really wealthy institutions over the last decade or so, going back to University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Princeton, sort of change focus for the first time, or certainly for most significantly in a long time, on getting more low-income students, sort of a recognition that that was a deficit for them, that that was a problem. And so they actually helped draw some attention to this. And so I think and there's just a recognition that if there's a desire to increase the number of people going to college, that it's increasingly going to come from populations that have not historically been well served in higher education, and the low income are chief among them. If you look at the data, are pretty amazing when you look at how much less likely a low income student is to graduate from college than a wealthy student. So there's just sort of this sense that this is if we need to get more people into and through college, and the federal government is putting more money into it, are we allocating it the right way? So that's kind of what I think is really driving the conversation. I mean, what's interesting to me, and I'd love to hear Steve talk about it a little bit, is there are institutions that have been focused on, a lot of the attention right now is on how the really wealthy institutions are doing. And there are a lot of institutions that have really, for a long time, served low-income students. And Steve, I'm sort of curious, when you look at this, the institutions that have really significant numbers of low-income students but aren't as wealthy aren't able to drive down their net price for those students, they seem very sympathetic to me in a lot of ways. And so I'm sort of, how do you look at sort of, and they don't fare very well in your assessment. So how do you look at that set of institutions?
Sure. I tried to, you know, be most critical of the ones that had money, but I do think, you know, I do think that I do have sympathy for them. And one of the recommendations that we have is for the government to provide Pell bonuses to schools that just don't have, that enroll a lot of low-income students. I'd say more than 25% of their student body is low-income, and to help them drive down the net price. We see this a lot in the private college sector. What was interesting to me is when you look at when you compare colleges that have under $100 million endowments to colleges that have over $500 million endowments or even $1 billion endowments, you see a huge difference in who is serving the low-income students, and that is the poorer schools.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I want to come back to the issue about the Pell bonus and some of the issues about what might happen with the reauthorization of the Higher Ed Act, but you've opened the door in the conversation earlier about what's going on in public institutions, and I think there's two parts of that we might discuss for a moment. One is the issue of state funding, you know, and how that might play into this in terms of the activity of the public institutions. There was a time, particularly in a number of states like New York, California, Georgia, where the states provided supplemental aid in some ways that was parallel to and significant for students enrolled in public institutions and even private institutions in the state. As the states have cut back on that, what's your sense about the impact of those cutbacks, plus the fact that as they've reduced allocations, the level of support that goes to help underwrite the academic program, that's contributed to rising tuition?
Undoubtedly, seeing both cutbacks in state funding and also cuts in need-based aid from states has played a role in making it less affordable for low-income students. I think what's interesting is that at the same time, a lot of these schools are starting to provide much more in merit aid, and part of that is because states have been divesting from their higher education systems, and as a result, colleges are looking for other sources of revenue. So they're going going much more aggressively after out-of-state students or international students. And when you look at, you know, there's sort of this fierce competition now for out-of-state students, and I think that's where a lot of the sort of merit aid is coming into play.
Doug, there's one bullet point in the report that just jumps, and that's the number that said in 1 year the percentage of students, low-income students, who have a net price of $10,000 or higher jumped by a third, from 32 to 45%. That's a huge bullet. What do you do with that as a journalist?
Well, I actually, maybe Steve, can you just give a little bit more information on what that, how that came about, what drove that?
Yeah, so that number, we sort of did two things in the report. One, I looked at just the 2011 and 12 net price numbers, and then I compared the colleges that I looked at last year. So this is the second volume of the report. So I had done a report back in May 2013. So when I looked at just those schools, which were, I believe, around 480 or so publics, that's where I saw the increase.
Mm-hmm. So does that becomes, so what do you attribute that to then, that increase?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, a lot of the report is focused on how colleges are using their institutional aid. Of course, mm-hmm. you know, state budget cuts help, but yeah, I mean, I was really surprised by the jump.
Yeah, I think it's something we're going to have to look into, Casey. The one little hopeful sign on the state side is that and I think reports like this actually are contributing to this kind of movement. But we did see states, even though state funding for all student aid stayed flat in 2012-13, which is the most recent year for which we have good data, the proportion going to need-based aid actually rose a little, which meant in retrospect that in comparison that the percentage of merit aid fell a little bit. So I think there is a lot of public pressure. Casey, you asked before about sort of what role whether there's PAC journalism, and there may be, but there's no question that there is increased pressure on this front. There's a movement by private institutions that's not going anywhere right now to sort of try and rein in merit aid. So I do think the public pressure and the policy pressure is shifting against merit aid and toward more need-based aid. The institutional imperatives are going to be hard to move because very few college presidents are sort of vocal advocates for merit aid, but a lot of them do it. And efforts to try to cut back on merit aid and drive need-based aid they run up against individual institutional needs. And so I think it's a hard needle to push, but I do think that there's a lot of pressure driving in that direction.
I want to touch on two issues as we close, before we close.
Sorry.
And the first is the naming names and the public shaming. I mean, some institutions, certainly Vassar, got great sound bites from the New York Times. On the other hand, Steve, your report offers a long list of institutions that's kind of a public shaming, and the Times did this to some degree as well. Washington University was singled out by the Times. There's a list of public and private institutions in your report where, again, low-income students pay big dollars, have a huge cost of attendance. What's your sense of the impact of that naming names and public shaming?
Well, as I said, I think it's before. I think it's. I didn't want to just have a theoretical discussion about this, but to really identify schools at which these practices were happening. And as I said, it's also important to identify schools that are going against the grain, such as Vassar, Franklin and Marshall, Hamilton, which has stopped offering merit aid. But more attention, you know, may help to change these practices. I was happy to hear that at Washington University in St. Louis, they seem to really be now engaged in an effort to go after low-income students, and I'm sure the public shaming that they've received over both from the New York Times, from people like us, but from plenty of other places as well, has contributed to their efforts.
So looming large in the future then, and Steve, you alluded to this earlier when you talked about Pell incentives or Pell bonuses, is the impending reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. Your work, the other work that's being done in other places, what does that suggest about policy changes in financial aid, particularly the Pell Grant programs, that will lead to greater accountability, greater incentives, greater pressures on institutions to bring down that high cost of attendance for many low-income students?
Well, we proposed a two-prong approach, both a carrot and a stick. The carrot being, as I said before, to offer Pell bonuses to both public and private colleges that serve a large number of Pell Grant recipients, but don't have the resources to really support them. And colleges could also use this money for support programs to increase retention and graduation rates of the low-income students on their campuses. The STIC part of it is to require schools that enroll a small share of low-income students but charge them very high net prices, and that would be that they would be required to match at least a share of the Pell dollars that they receive. And with the aim being that they would shift money back from merit aid to need-based aid. So those are the policies that we've put forward.
And Doug, as you watch the ramp up to reauthorization, you know, what's your sense that there's going to be a deep dive not just into the money, but again the kinds of policies and incentives and sticks that Steve alluded to a moment ago?
Well, it's really hard to say. I mean, the Higher Education Act has become a bit of a Christmas tree on which lots of ancillary things get hung, and the important sort of core financial aid discussions and decisions. I think there's been a huge amount of discussion in the last year and a half about sort of real significant changes to financial aid. It's hard for me to imagine that we're going to have sort of rethinking of federal financial aid that a lot of people have called for. I think some of the changes along the lines of what Steve and New America are calling for in this report could conceivably happen, but I wouldn't be holding anybody's breath for a quick reauthorization anytime soon. So I think we're going to see more pressure along these lines in the meantime.
Great. Thanks to you both for an interesting and engaging conversation. This is an issue to watch. In our second segment today, we're going to talk about a fight over accessibility with the Higher Education Act. The approaching ubiquity of technology resources, such as digital content and simulations in the curricula and web-based campus services, is having a Pandora's box-like effect for disabled students and the colleges they attend. At one level, certain types of adaptive technologies do aid and assist disabled students. Yet at another level, the expansion of online courses and the movement to digital course resources pose new challenges for disabled students, their instructors, their institutions, and also for the firms that provide technology platforms and develop course materials for the college market. This tension is now evident in the discussions underway about the TEACH Act, supported by groups that advocate for disabled students and incorporated into the draft of the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, put forward by Senator Tom Harkin. But the TEACH Act provisions are opposed by many of the DuPont Circle associations that represent college and universities in Washington. Advocates for TEACH say it may resolve much of the current ambiguity about accessibility by setting technical standards to assist the efforts of colleges and universities to serve disabled students. In contrast, the higher education associations, which state that they clearly share the concern for serving disabled students, view the provisions of the TEACH Act as an expansion of regulations that, quote, create a new standard for accessibility that would essentially eliminate the existing provisions of the current accessibility law and regulation, and that allow institutions to meet a student's need in relation to the curriculum in question and the technologies available. So joining us for this conversation are Kyle Shackmut, who is president of the National Federation for the Blind. He's also a doctoral student in educational media, and Doug Letterman, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. We were scheduled to have Jared Cummings, director of policy and external relations at EDUCAUSE, join us. Jared called in sick this morning, and on short notice, we were not able to secure the participation of another representative from one of the DuPont Circle associations for this conversation. So, Doug, let me begin. What's the real issue here? The American for Disabilities Act has been the law of the land for a long time, and many colleges really are making real efforts to address the physical and digital challenges that confront disabled students. And yet, clearly, there have been problems. There's a long list of articles that are in the digital archives at Inside Higher Ed of issues, and in some cases, court decisions or other decisions at individual colleges. Is there a need for new legislation? Is there a need for new regulation or guidelines?
Well, so I will let Kyle sort of offer the explanation for why he thinks there is a need. And since we don't have somebody arguing for the college's view, I will just sort of present their view a little bit. So they first of all really bristle at the idea that they don't care about students with disabilities, and they feel like this the way this is being framed, sort of presented, it makes it look like they don't. They are trying, and as you say, there's a bunch of examples of places that have struggled with it, and it is a with all the new technologies, they're struggling a lot. They have two main objections here. One, they think the Higher Education Act in general is the wrong vehicle to deal with this. The Higher Ed Act has become something of a Christmas tree in recent years, where a whole bunch of issues that aren't about federal financial aid get attached to it. They also more sort of fundamentally are worried. They don't believe that this is just some new guidelines that will help students in colleges. They really believe that the way this piece of legislation, this provision is framed, it would clash with the ADA and really be inconsistent with the ADA, and they don't see it as just a clarification, or they really see it as a vast expansion of the and a change in how the federal government sort of pursues this by putting the guidelines in the hands of a very small and federal agency, and so they have some real trouble with this, and they insist that they're really objecting to what is the right vehicle to accomplish what they think is a shared goal.
Kyle Schachmark, you're with the National Federation of the Blind, one of the agencies and one of the advocate groups that's very much supportive of the TEACH Act. Is there a need for new legislation?
I think there absolutely is. You know, I think everybody who has been discussing this problem this week has clearly acknowledged there is a big problem. Universities, in various ways, aren't providing the level of equal access that the students are demanding, and it's coming to a head most sharply around these new technologies. And that's why we've looked at the data that has come out over the past many years, recommendations from commissions and studies, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And while the law currently states that schools must provide equal access, there are no technical criteria telling them how to do so. And the TEACH Act, or the proposed language in HEA, would give technical criteria that the industry, that technology companies and publishers, could then use to build products that universities could purchase, which would thereby make it easier for them to give this greater accessibility to students. You know, it's often the case that students run into accessibility barriers at every phase of the educational process, right? They go online to try to register for courses, and they oftentimes find they can't do it. They'll get a syllabus from an instructor on the first day of class, and they can't read it because it wasn't made accessible. They'll try to go and get their textbooks, and the textbooks aren't accessible, so they fall 3 or 4 weeks behind while people scan in and make an old paper-based copy in the old system. They'll try to use advanced features of a learning management system to do their course discussions or their weekly assignments, and they won't necessarily be able to access it. They'll go to the library to write their final papers, and they can't access the library database system. And then they get to the stage where they want to go online and find their grades, and they can't even access the grading system. So there are a whole lot of barriers kind of at every phase of the educational process in this, and it's clear that schools haven't been able to ensure the access demanded by students, so the guidelines would help really fill in the gaps for the existing laws.
Well, one of the questions about the guidelines, Kyle and Doug, seems to be, are they technical standards or, in fact, are they regulations? And you've both alluded to the technology parts of this. And as I've sort of scanned a lot of the stuff that's out there, including some of the stuff that the article in Inside Higher Ed today, Kyle, your paper in the Boston Post, you know, technology is a fast-moving environment. Bureaucracies move much slower. You know, is it reasonable to expect that a set of standards that come through a committee that will set a set of standards about the world as it is or maybe even was 6 months ago are applicable to the needs of students 6 months or a year from now? You know, the institutions seem to argue for individualization. The TEACH Act would seem to argue for standards that provide a common denominator, whether that's a lowest or mid-level common denominator. Kyle, let me turn that to you.
Sure. Well, the TEACH Act calls on the Access Board to make technology technical criteria. And so it's loosely defined ways that technology companies can build around these technical criteria to meet accessibility standards. I think it's really unfair to characterize, as some have recently, that innovation is impeded by accessible technology. I think most people would assume or would agree that Apple is one of the most innovative, if not the most innovative technology company in the world. All of their products are accessible. They found a way to be both very innovative and very creative with their technology and to build in accessibility. And so it's a big misnomer to instantly assume that just because something's accessible, that it's not innovative. Those just, they aren't mutually exclusive.
Well, Doug, as somebody who has to cover this as a journalist, I mean, what's your sense? Are these regulations, are these technical standards, are they malleable enough if they're written into the legislation of the Higher Education Reauthorization to keep up with the changes in technology and innovations that would provide in more access, as Kyle is suggesting?
Well, I think what takes them beyond guidelines is, as I read it, is that it would, essentially the way I understand it is that colleges would either have to use only instructional materials that conform to the guidelines, or they'd have to assure the education department that they are providing disabled students with materials that are sort of substantially equivalent to those provided to their non-disabled peers. So there's no question that it would create a new, as I read it at least, a new standard that's not just, that goes beyond guidelines. So I think they're pretty clearly sort of a regulation that colleges would have to meet. And, you know, again, I'm not taking a side on whether it's appropriate, but I don't think it doesn't seem to be any question that it goes beyond just guidelines. There is, you know, there would basically be this panel that would be charged with sort of setting putting a stamp on a set of technologies that are approved, and then if an institution wants to use something else, it would have to sort of justify that. And that's certainly a regulatory act of some kind. So I think it's pretty clear that there's a new set of regulations in this bill. Kyle, do you disagree with that?
I do, in that those specific languages where you referenced substantially equivalent ease of use, those are taken from the existing regulations and laws that are already on the books. And this is fleshing it out in an educational context. In fact, I'll just read the first sentence of one of these provisions. It says, "Nothing in this act shall be construed to require an institution of higher education to use electronic instructional materials or related information technology or to conform to accessibility guidelines." And then it goes on to reference these existing standards, the existing standard of equal access that they must provide, and still allowing them the flexibility for accommodation. So to say that this is something completely new, it's referencing old law, but as I mentioned, it's filling in the gaps, because clearly there are gaps that schools aren't able to meet the equal access that's already required of them.
Hey, Kyle, it seems that one of the arguments that the colleges make, is that the regulation would impede their efforts to individualize. That, yes, this is a set of daunting challenges in many cases. Individual needs may vary across the different needs of different students with different kinds of disabilities, and that by creating a regulatory environment, whether they're technical standards or new regulations, that body of something that becomes the guidance or the regulation would impede, again, that effort in individual response. Is that a fair response?
I don't think that it is. You know, there are current, when we think of, like, building infrastructure, buildings, there are regulations and guidelines that say everybody or every building needs to have an elevator. And it doesn't mean that everybody has to use the elevator, but by having it there by default in new construction, it allows access by everybody more equally. And there still might be other ways where an experience is customized or adapted further, but building things in by design and starting with these technical criteria, it allows for the flexibility of individualized accommodations to be much more meaningful than having no baseline of accessibility from which to start.
Doug, Kyle mentioned providers. I mentioned providers, the curriculum providers and the technology providers. One of the questions I have is, who's the real target here? I mean, is it really to change the behavior of the institutions, or use the institutions as a leverage point to pressure whether it's platform providers who make computers and tablets, whether it's the curriculum providers, such as textbook companies and others, to be sure that, in fact, curricular resources and campus services are readily and easily available for the disabled.
Well, my sense is it's both, that there's a desire to the providers are probably not going to change or at least aren't going to feel as much pressure to change unless and until their customers, who are the institutions, well, ultimately it's the students, but through the institutions typically, feel like they have to or choose to. And so I think it is a wedge to get the technology companies to change. My sense, and Kyle, you may be able to speak to this, my sense is that some of the technology companies are on board with this. Exactly why, I mean, some of it may be for competitive reasons because it sort of sets a new standard for what, it may help them keep out competitors. But I think that some of the technology companies, as I understand it, are supportive of this legislation. And I think it's very much about getting the colleges to change their behavior. I don't think there's any question about that.
So, Kyle, let me ask a variation on that same question, recalling that the National Federation of the Blind was very much involved and very much opposed to a Kindle pilot project some years ago that involved seven institutions. Clearly a pilot project, clearly voluntary. There was a lawsuit against Arizona State. There was pressure. It pushed from the Department of Education and the Department of Justice on some of the other institutions that ultimately led to an agreement not to promote the Kindle. It seemed that the ultimate target of that initiative by your organization, or the parent organization, was less on the institutions and more on Amazon, yet the institutions incurred the cost of that initiative.
Well, the target for all of these initiatives are the students, and it's really about providing equal access to all of the students. And the schools have a legal obligation to do so, and the technology companies who want to sell their products to the schools should make products that comply and help the schools comply with those laws. It's, as we mentioned, at all phases of the whole curricular experience, students are facing these challenges, and all of these efforts are in an effort to give students the equal access that they are entitled to by law. You know, the AIM Commission, the Accessible Instructional Materials Commission, they produced their report in 2011. They actually, their number one recommendation for how to address accessible instructional materials was guidelines, which turned into the TEACH Act. And in the report, they said that there's an epidemic of a failure for students with disabilities to matriculate in universities, and that there's a real persistent unmet need in how schools are addressing the challenge. So something has to be done. And kind of in this whole broad conversation that's happened a little bit this week, right now this is the best proposal that we have on the table. We're willing to work with others. We want a solution because there's this big problem, but right now there's no alternative other than to do nothing and kind of maintain the status quo.
So, Doug, on that, something that needs to be done. One of the people quoted in this morning's article about this issue in Inside Higher Ed said, agreed with Kyle's assessment, something needs to be done, but maybe TEACH is not the best way to do it. As you think about the reauthorization of higher education, of the Higher Education Act going forward, the fact that the TEACH provisions have been incorporated into this first draft of the legislation, what's your best guess of how this goes forward?
Well, on so many fronts, the colleges are feeling defensive and like they're being told what to do, and in general on lots of issues. Whenever I'm talking to them, this happens on the rating system, it happens on all sorts of ways to sort of hold them accountable. They are certainly better off when they come up with their own ways of doing it, as long as they really do it. So I think if I don't know how open the advocates like Kyle will be for, but I think if the higher ed establishment wants to do things their own way, there's one way to do that, which is to try to come up with proposals that go further than what they've done before, and that they think that satisfy advocates and lawmakers that it's going to be effective. And you know, hopefully, I mean, there's not a lot of agreement on anything in Washington these days, but you'd like to think that a process that works like that, where the colleges come forward and say, this is what we're willing to do, that through compromise you get there. But I think if they don't come up with their own proposals, I think they're going to, this is an issue on which I think it makes them, it's hard for them to take the high road here and to look good. So I think they have to do something meaningful, or they're going to get something like this imposed on them.
Great. That's a good way to end our conversation, as we see what, in fact, it is that the colleges bring forward as an alternative and meaningful proposal. Thank you both for your time today. Thank you for joining us this week. And our thanks to the individuals who aided and informed our conversations: Stephen Bund from the New America Foundation, Kyle Shachmut, president of the National Federation of the Blind in Massachusetts, and Doug Letterman, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.